Do you want to become a better songwriter? Well, we created a very simple 10-minute songwriter personality test, and it's going to help you better understand who you are as a writer, and it's going to help you in the writer's room when you're writing with other writers, because you're going to be able to identify what kind of writer they are. Maybe even have them take the songwriter personality test. If you're curious and you want to take the songwriter personality test today, just visit songwriterpersonalitytest.com or go to the link on the writingworship.co website.
Welcome to the Writing Worship Podcast, a place for kingdom-minded songwriters to grow in their craft and community.
Welcome to the Writing Worship Podcast. I'm Eric Nordoff, and you are in for a treat today. If you are interested in doing more with your music as an artist, then this is the right place for you. Drew Small, who is a music marketing and artist coach, music marketing expert and artist coach, his tagline is helping artists grow more than 1 million fans in 1 year. That's pretty cool. He's definitely worth the follow at It's Drew Small on Instagram. And he gives a ton of great content to our writing club, great value to our writing club community, where Nick Morrow, our director of Writing Worship, interviews him. And then, of course, he goes on. We also went on for another 45 minutes with Drew inside of the writing club that was not recorded, where everyone who was participating got to ask questions. Some great insight was given to everyone. Drew Small is definitely the man when it comes to music marketing and coaching artists. You're going to love it. Here it is, our conversation with Drew Small.
Drew Small, Marketing Miyagi, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here.
My man, you may have done this before. You and I have done this kind of thing before, but I don't remember if I did this last time, but we do the lightning round questions at the very beginning.
We did do the lightning round. I'm ready for it.
So this is a whole new show. Okay. Answer from the gut. Don't think too hard about these questions. Some people really get stuck on these. My first question, I've already asked the whole group, but I'll ask you again. On a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being the worst day of your life, 10 being the best day of your life, how are you doing today?
I'm a solid 7. I did have a dog steal my lunch and then trick me by running away. So, you know, that took a couple points off, but as a whole, it's a good day.
Wait. Let's give me unpack that for a second. A dog stole your lunch.
Correct.
And tricked you by running away.
Yeah. So I have two dogs. One dog ran away so the other dog could steal the lunch.
Yeah.
They work in teams.
It was a hit job.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Okay. I'm so sorry. Have you eaten lunch?
I did eat lunch. I did get a lunch after I hosed the dog that likes to run away also likes to find the neighborhood horse stall to roll in the poop. So.
Oh, goodness.
We hosed him down in the front yard. We're all good.
This is like, you know how when you like go to the grocery store and like your toddler's throwing a tantrum and you're like, this is birth control for all the people who aren't parents yet?
100%.
What you're doing for me is like dog birth control. I never want a dog.
I mean, that's as bad as it gets. That's about it. We don't have like going to the bathroom in the house or chewing stuff up. It's mostly snuggles and barks at the mailman.
Okay. All right. That's not so bad.
Yeah.
Okay. Next question. If you're going to a desert island and you can only take the catalog of 3 songwriters with you, who are you going with?
Oh, Radiohead for sure. Oh gosh, that's good. Okay. Radiohead. I would probably take somebody in the lo-fi space, like maybe Cold Brew. And then Queen.
Oh, I was going to say, you need something happy.
Yeah.
You have like chill music and Radiohead. You need something to get you up.
Yeah, I definitely need something to get up. But cold brew has quite a few stuff. They've made a pivot in the last couple of years where it's like less really calm ambient stuff and more like jazzy, almost club stuff.
Okay. Guys, fun fact about Drew, you also do some artist things. You do a lot of things.
I do. I stay busy, as the kids say.
What's your artist name?
I have a lo-fi project under the name Rui. R-O-O-E-Y.
Amazing. Which you can go check out now. We'll come back to that and talk a little bit of all about artists and marketing, all this stuff. Okay. Last question is this. This is a really serious one. If you could only listen to one song for the rest of your life, but that you have to pick one of these three songs. How Bizarre, the OMC hit from the 90s, Putting on the Ritz, Taco from the 80s, or the Pina Colada song. Which one are you going to pick?
Oh, if you like Pina Coladas, all day.
That song is a jam.
All day. All three of those that are going to now be stuck in my head for the rest of the week. So I would
there you go.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome, guys. I'm just trying to do the Lord's work out here. Amazing. Well, guys, I want to get right to it because we brought in Drew. We kind of do all different things. We bring in artists and publishers and different kinds of people. But one of the questions that we get a lot of, because many of us are artists in the writing worship community, is about like, what the heck do I do with my music after it's done? You know, after I have a master in hand and I've sent it to the distributor, it's about to come out on Spotify. What do I do then? And this is like Drew's specialty. Basically, I want to start with this question, though, because I do actually think in the Christian space, if we don't answer this question first, there's going to be a wrestle. And Chris Van Dyne, you're on with us. I'm so glad because you kind of asked this question in so many words. And many people ask me this question. I hear it all the time. Drew, you probably do, too. Some version of this. How do we live as Christians and try to be, you know, picking up our cross and losing our life and not be self-promoting and all these things that Jesus teaches us and be an artist who is like inherently having to promote my own music and stuff at the same time. Do you wrestle with this tension and where are your philosophies on that?
Yeah, we hear this a lot. I think the first thing I'll say is that most of the time, this is just pride masquerading as false humility, right? If God has called you to be a songwriter and present the gospel in musical form to the world, and you want to put your light under a bushel and hide it because you think it's self-promotion, then maybe you misunderstood the call, right? That when Jesus says that we're supposed to go to Judea, Samaria, to the ends of the earth and beyond, that involves actually getting outside your comfort zone and doing things that don't necessarily feel normal to you. If you want, like my philosophy, to sidestep the question a little bit, is that everything is just creative expression until it gets shared. The minute that something gets shared is when it becomes art, right? And so we can creatively express ourselves in all manner of ways, but it doesn't become art until it's shared. And art is really important. And if God has called you into the arts and to use this thing that is art, in order for it to be art and for you to step into that calling, it requires sharing it. You're not so much promoting yourself as well. I think that's the other misconception here, is that marketing your music and telling people about the songs that you wrote is only self-promotion when the framework within which you expect to interface with your fan base is as the central figurehead, right? So we're looking at David Bowie or Dua Lipa or these artists that their existence is the thing, right? Your job is to be less of the main character and more of the guide, right? You're helping people, especially in the worship world. Your job is to be a Sherpa to help people navigate from here on earth to there in heaven. So it's not about you. It's about equipping your audience member to successfully make that journey from one place to another through the vehicle of your music.
We could talk for an hour about just this, and maybe it's helpful if we do dig in for a while, because I find personally, Drew, I think you've even been a voice who's helped me understand this more and more, particularly as a Christian artist and as someone who is hopefully living out the Great Commission of evangelism, telling people about Jesus in some form or another. the more I've understood this that you're talking about, that I am not, like, if, for instance, a new song comes out, Drew, you and I were both just on a thread with somebody on Threads that said, I have a new song coming out and I don't like self-promoting. How should I talk about it?
That's right.
And I think you and I both responded to it. And in essence, it was like, why did you write this song?
Right.
Like, why are you putting the song in the world? And what do you hope that I, like, what's your hopes for how I might encounter Jesus with this song?
Yeah.
In some way or another. And I feel like the more I can understand talking about the mission and more really talking about Jesus, the less about myself, then it's like the song can be it's a part of the journey, or it's the diving board, right, or whatever, but it's not the end goal.
Correct. Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. I think too, like, marketing is often misunderstood. So much about marketing is just good storytelling and helping people understand the story of how your song fits into their life and into their world. And when you're going out there and you're posting, I would imagine most of us are going to be posting to platforms like Instagram or TikTok or YouTube Shorts, or we're going to use social media as our primary driver from a marketing standpoint. There, like, if we just talk about Instagram for a second, there's 96 million Instagram posts that are put up every single day. And so your job as you're promoting your song is to use story and to use, you know, this medium as a reason why people would stop and spend some time on your post. I think a lot of times our perception is when we're doing marketing for our music, it's, hey, I've got a new song out, you can listen to it now. That's actually bad marketing. Good marketing doesn't feel at all like marketing. Good marketing is something where we're exchanging our time for some semblance of value. And that value may come in the form of just playing the song. That value may come in the form of a story that explains to us how that song might fit in our life. Because if we're honest, our songs are not meant to be played 24/7, 365 days a year. Our songs are specific to a moment. So your marketing's job is to tell the story of when that moment is. So your audience might find themselves in that time and space and go, oh, that song's appropriate, right? So it's, I think we can easily walk away from this idea that marketing your music is self-promotion. It's only self-promotion if you're doing it wrong, right?
Good. It's only self-promoting if you're being self-promoting.
Yeah.
And I find too, I think, guys, we talked about this on another call recently. I think on our Connect call, we were pulling some of this stuff apart. But I find that if I just pause for 10 seconds and say a prayer of like, okay, Lord, how maybe might I do this and tell your story through this? It completely reframes even the ideas that I have and the ways that I talk to people. It's so crazy to me the way I see most Christian artists doing marketing, which, as you say, is pretty much bad marketing. Hey, what's up? My name's Nick, and I just want to tell you about the new Writing Worship Community single. Go listen. Here's how, you know, like, and there's all this stuff. Instead of just like straight in, you already only have like half a second of people's attention. So it's like straight in, I can say, I don't know, start telling a story about Jesus or an encounter with Jesus or fill in the blank. Right. And it can be very intriguing. And hopefully change my heart and the anyone listening.
It is. And it's also, it's a lot of human psychology, right? Like, throughout all of human history, we have surrounded ourselves around oral tradition. And so, like, even the way your brain neurologically works, there's this part that's called the prefrontal cortex. And that's the part of your brain that's like trying to figure out how you're going to pay your bills. Is it safe to cross the street? What's the weather going to be today? This is like an always on part of our brain, except for when we are told stories, that part of our brain turns off. And so a lot of people forget that story is a superpower. And a lot of times you can use story to help people disengage from that doom scroll that is happening on social media. And again, it's not even so much, there's a like a great example of this. There's a hip hop artist named Connor Price. Connor Price, prior to COVID, was a film and TV actor. And when COVID hit, auditions stopped. And so he and his wife, he had previously been releasing music just like kind of under a pseudonym and a little bit secretly and feeling some of this similar, like I'm ashamed or nervous or don't want to self-promote, whatever. And in COVID, he and his wife kind of threw themselves headfirst into it. And he uses this tactic in all of his social media where he is telling a story that hooks you in. He's actually using his skill as an actor. Not that you have to act on social media. There's no one way to do it, but this is a good example in that he puts on these skits or these sketches, or he tells a little bit of a story and gets us invested in what's going on in that moment. And then the tail end of his content is him performing his song. And so there's almost never a, hey, this song's available here or go click there. It's literally just the whole point of the post is to entertain and engage an audience. It's not at all meant to sell anything to people. In fact, probably only one in 10 posts should be like a direct sale thing. Everything else is just nurturing people. And so Connor does this really, really great job of creating what I call contextless content. This is a piece of social media that any person on planet Earth could watch, and they don't need to know that he used to be an actor. They don't need to know what kind of genre. They don't need any other information other than being there right then in that moment. And what's really interesting is when Connor started this in 2020, he had no monthly listeners. And now he probably nets, I was just talking with his manager the other day, it's like between $30,000 and $40,000 a month just from Spotify streams alone, because he understands that social media is, we're not competing with, when we're on Instagram or TikTok or whatever, those platforms aren't competing with each other. They're competing with Netflix, they're competing with Hulu, they're competing with the news. And there's this opportunity on these short form social media platforms to use story, to use entertainment, to use, you know, a little bit of just your superpower as a songwriter, as a performer, to engage people without selling, without self-promoting. And, you know, the average American spends about 90 minutes a day on social media at minimum, right? So those platforms, it's really easy to build large audiences on them because users are there to, you know, if they come across a piece of content that they like, what they're going to do is go through to your profile and see if there's more of it. And if there's more of it, they're going to follow you, right? And it's basically like as they're doom scrolling and the algorithm serves them a tall drink of water from your well, if that quenches their thirst and there's more to drink, they're going to continue to drink. Because again, people are totally happy to invest 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes on their favorite side character. They're not necessarily interested in sitting down and watching, you know, long form content these days. It's becoming increasingly more and more difficult. So that's the advantage that you have. And again, story is your superpower. It's not about like figuring out how to go viral or keeping things under 7 seconds or any of these like, you know, quote unquote guru tricks. The core mechanic of going viral on a consistent basis is to understand that time is a non-renewable resource and you have to put stuff out there that people are willing to spend time interacting with.
So good. That's so good. I feel like the next logical question I feel like for those on with us and even those listening is sort of this. I know so much of what you talk about, Drew, is actually having to convince artists that they should spend time and money on marketing. Like you shouldn't, and how many of us, don't put your hand up, but I would, I'm guilty of this, have blown our entire budget that we have or whatever, what Kickstarter fundraising or whatever. And I have this chunk of money and I spend 97% of it or more, and some of my own money even, on getting the thing made and maybe a video. And then zero money for marketing. My question to you is, walk that back for us, why we should save money for the marketing and time and energy and all of that.
Yeah. I mean, this is a tale as old as time. I think there's this, first of all, it's hard for a lot of artists to not record every song that they write, right? To you, you believe in all of them and you want to put them all out there. And so I think a lot of artists will make more songs than they really need to. And there is also this unrealistic idolization of the album, of the 12 song packaging of songs, of music. And really, just to first hit on, the only reason why albums are 12 songs is it's a limitation of the physical product manufacturing, right? We started collecting about 12 songs, about 90 minutes worth of music together, because that's how long vinyl could sustain. That's how long cassettes could sustain. So when we look at the album, as I think so many people conceptualize it, it really just is a function of like a capitalistic society being able to take art and turn it into a commodity. And so when we look to how most people consume music today, it's through streaming. We see the reason, like there's a lot of, you know, downplay on the EP or on the single, and they all want to do a full album. But realistically, you have 60 to 100,000 songs releasing daily. So when you put out 12 songs, it's, you know, it's a lot, but it also gets lost in that sea of music. And when you're, you know, like I just, with my lo-fi project, that whole project exists a little bit because I like to make music and it's a fun little self-expression thing, but primarily it's just a sandbox for me to figure out how stuff works without having to worry about some manager buying likes on Instagram or, you know, somebody doing something that, you know, I'm not aware of. Like, it's literally this project where nothing happens to it unless my team or I do something to it. So we get really good data out of the if this, then that. And it's also a safe place for me to go like, hey, I have an idea. I think that we might do X and get Y result. And we don't have to take that risk on a client's campaign, right? I can just safely go there. So we just got through a year of a song a month, and it was too much. It was a really unsustainable pace for me. It was also like, when you think about editorial playlist placements and things like that, curators and staff at DSPs, they can't feature you every month, right? And that can be a really core component, especially in the Christian space. Being able to net placements like New Music Friday Christian or any of the Apple Music placements that are available, those really make or break your ability to stand out in the market. And it sometimes can be the difference between your song existing and your song not existing. And so if you're putting a song out every month, you're actually putting yourself a little bit at a disadvantage because you can't actually get the level of support that your songs may need. Beyond that, again, you're putting a bunch of money into the production, sometimes thousands of dollars per track. There is no other business in the world, none, where you don't have to market your music, right? It just really doesn't exist. And I don't understand why artists assume that because you made something, the world owes you to, like, owes anything to you to consume it or to monetize it or anything. Like, no one owes you anything. Right? No one owes you their time. You are asking people to take their non-renewable resource of time, right? We can make almost anything else that's a resource in this world. We cannot make more time. Once it's gone, it's gone. And when you make your art, you are asking people to give you that time that they cannot get back. And you're, when artists don't think that they need to spend money or put effort into marketing that music, it creates this self-fulfilling prophecy of, I'm not good at this, I don't belong here. And that's just not true, right? There are so many great artists that I've worked with along the way that have made great and beautiful art, but there's this misunderstanding that like pushing that publish button on that post guarantees you any kind of exposure. And it negates the reality of just how humans build relationship with products and brands. No one makes a decision based off a single Instagram post. 85% of the conversions in our digital marketing campaigns happen somewhere between the fifth and the 12th touch point. right? So when we go out there and we spend all this money on music, and especially when it's like, these are worship songs that you strongly feel like, a lot of times when I talk with worship artists, there's like some Moses in the burning bush moment where the Lord spoke to them really clearly, like, you're going to go do this, right? And the way that I'll frame it is like, let's say we're farmers and God's called us to grow a crop to feed, you know, a population. God's job is to let the rain fall when it falls and the sun shine when it shines. It's our job to plow the field. It's our job to plant seed. It's our job to irrigate that field if the rain doesn't fall the way it's supposed to fall. It's our job to make sure that the pests don't steal up the crops. It's our job to do most of the work, right? There is a co-laborer that is always mandatory with Christ. There is a co-laborer with marketing that is mandatory. And you would be better served to release less songs, but have them be of higher quality so that you're standing out from your competition, and also include some semblance of a marketing strategy so that you can actually continue to do this going forward. So you might get to all of your songs eventually, but it will probably take you longer to put them out than you would like. But, and I'll land the plane on this, is that the greatest threat to any artist's brand is going to be the boredom of insiders, right? You want to put these songs out. You're like a 12-year-old with a $20 bill in their pocket, right? You have spent sometimes days, weeks, months writing these songs and producing these songs. And then you hit that publish button and you might do marketing for a month. That's just not enough time, right? You're bored with your songs, or you're slightly embarrassed that you continue to talk about them, or, you know, you just want to move on. But the reality is there are 8+ billion people on the planet, and a good portion of them speak English, and a good portion of them listen to worship music. So until you've made a concerted effort to actually saturate that market with the messaging about the songs that you're putting out, it's not time to move on. You know, there's a lot of artists that I see breaking that are releasing a lot less songs and putting a lot more effort into talking about those songs at scale and doing the hard thing of not getting bored and moving on to something else. This is definitely one of those industries where it is a marathon and not a sprint. And 90% of your success is going to come from like consistently doing the most obvious thing for an uncommonly long period of time.
This is so good. I'm sure I'm not the only one feeling right now that, Drew, when does the pre-sale for your book link go out? Because I'm going to buy it. And
I do have a book on Amazon. My business partner and I wrote about kind of how to tell story as an artist. Maybe I should have prefaced with that.
Oh, yeah. Drop it in. Will you drop it in the in the chat?
I'll find a link and drop it in the chat. We'll, I also am notoriously bad at self-promotion as well. So thank you for that product placement opportunity.
I'm doing it for you, and we'll put it in the show notes as well. So for those listening back to the podcast, we'll have that in the show notes. I just wanted to, like, as a person who's a songwriter and an artist and a worship leader and all these things, that you're hitting a lot of you're hitting the ringing the bell for me in a lot of it, like from a lot of angles right now, Drew. I think that I have slowly but surely been more and more and more convinced by people like you, and also from doing it the wrong way for a long time, that, okay, so as songwriters, all of you will resonate with this. Like, we would resonate with this idea that God gives us an idea and it's our job to steward the idea. And then if we're, you know, maybe you're an artist or you're on a worship team, your church releases music. I know tons of you guys do that. Then, like, to get the song, like, recorded, pre-production, production, get it mixed, get it mastered, we're not sitting around saying, like, well, I'm just going to let God do that for me. Like, with any of that, I'm just restating what you said, Drew, but this is kind of the way that I've come to be convicted about it. So why on earth, I hear so many people saying, and I've said it before, like, I'm just going to let the Lord do whatever he's going to do with the release of this song and just breathe on it.
Trust he'll breathe on it. Yeah.
Just trust that he will. It's like, well, I'm not just going to trust that the Lord's going to mix the song, because he's like, that's your job. That's part of stewarding. And I've now come to include in my in my idea of stewardship, this like churchy or financial word that we use, but like our creative stewardship, I've come to now include the marketing or communication about that song to the world as a part of what it means to be a good steward of that song or that piece of work. And that has really changed the game for me in terms of like just getting something out there and people actually hearing it. And I would say this too, the more places that a song can be, the more places it can minister to people.
Yeah.
So like it only helps the potential ministry impact of something. Anyway, I'm just saying here to everything you're saying. I'm just a hype man today.
Well, thanks, my guy. I would say too, if you guys haven't read Ari Herstand's How to Make It in the New Music Business, and you haven't, I'm sure someone has told you you need to read that already. Let this be like the actual confirmation. Go read the book. It's really, really good. Every time he puts out a new version of it, I read it. I keep it on my desk. I probably reference it 2 or 3 times a week. It's really, really solid if you're trying to figure out, because there's so much to this that I would say that's probably my number one resource for new artists.
Mm.
It's How to Make It in the New Music Business. There's the 3rd edition. It's by a man named Ari Herstand.
I love how you just like skipped right over your own book and gave a nice long commercial for Ari's book.
I mean, Ari's book is like everything music business related.
He's great. Yeah.
Once you understand kind of like, so much of my job as a marketer is to be a little bit of an economist and a business strategist. And like, I find myself doing that more with artists, because a lot of times marketing is perceived like it's this kind of slot machine where we're going to pull a lever and we hope we hit a jackpot. But the actuality of it all is it's a vending machine where we have a desired outcome. We know what we're trying to do with our business, with our like whether you want to accept it or not. If you're putting music out on modern streaming platforms, you've started a music business, and that business needs to have some pathway towards monetization. Streaming is a pathway only at scale. Up until anything before, 100,000 or 150,000 monthly listeners, that's just a marketing opportunity, right? It's just a place where you can drive people to engage with your music. You're making at most half a penny per stream, and then you split that up between how many co-writers you have, and it only works at scale. So you've got to figure out, how else are you monetizing? Is it through shows? Is it through resources? Is it through merch? Is it through what, what's your path? Go ahead.
Could I add this on? Like, this is a question for you, Drew.
Yeah.
Would it be true then in saying, I feel that deeply, that like Spotify is an amazing marketing tool, but like, don't make much money off of it. But people discovering our music, it's been incredible. Correct. So to your point then, you're saying figure out the other ways that you're going to monetize music and make money, whether it's shows or merch or fill in the blank.
Yeah.
Then would you also say that figuring out how to link Spotify to get people to those places?
Yes and no. Typically, people aren't going to leave one platform to go to another, right? So you may be driving traffic into Spotify through ads, or you might run a playlist pitch campaign, or you might, be an itinerant worship leader and, end up at a camp or a school or another church, and you might talk about your music and they can go find you that way. Not a lot of people are leaving Spotify. Most people are just turning it on and then you have to understand that music is a context specific art form. And so most of the time there are very few instances where people are just solely focused on your music, and especially on streaming platforms, right? Very rarely do people just sit down and put on headphones and just listen to an album. It's always a companion to some other activity, behavior, attitude, mood. And so, yeah, you should have your profile optimized that people can find you in other places, but are people going to, like, in all the campaigns and all the clients I've had over the years, and that's a big number, the number of traffic or the volume of traffic that I get coming out of Spotify into other ecosystems is almost negligible.
Mm.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. So
it is changing a little bit. Spotify has really made some big moves in the last 6 months really on how their platform functions. They're starting to incorporate Shopify, things like that. So it's potential that we'll start to see that change, but by and large, that's kind of a cul-de-sac. You know, people are coming in from somewhere else and they kind of get stuck in there.
And
that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's do this. Let's like get super practical because I'm staring at the faces of my friends on with us and no doubt many more listening back later that are artists that have a very limited budget. And I'll just to make it easy so I don't just pick someone at random on the call. I'm looking at many of you guys who I know are artists. But Writing Worship Community is about to release our first record. And, you know, doing that with along with a label partner who's doing distribution, a publisher, and a very limited budget. Many of you guys were involved in that, whether writing or leading or being part of the choir, whatever. And a lot of these guys on this call are doing their own similar things, artist project, church projects, all that kind of thing. Drew, what is your, like, if you're walking with a client into this, you've got a limited budget, all this, what's sort of your first moves in terms of what clients can do to get the message, to market the message about Jesus, about their music on a very limited budget?
Yeah, that's a good question. And fortunately, I find myself there a lot. The first thing we're going to do is kind of figure out what we're working with. Do they have any existing social media audience? How are they on social media? Are they comfortable in front of the camera? And we're also going to do a little bit of like, I would say you've got to figure out how do you define a win for that release? Because I think a lot of people don't set specific measurable goals for their releases. And so if you don't set a goal for what you hope to see that do for the overall, you know, structure of your music business, you might end up hitting a slam dunk and having no clue about it, right? So making sure before you even put together a plan, you go, okay, well, what's a win for this? And I would say the way that you figure out what a win is to recognize that the only person you're actually in competition with is yourself. You're not competing with other artists or other, you know, brands or entities. This is community over competition is always the best way to perceive this. Your job with each release is to get better results than you did the last time, right? If you're really going to build something. So be honest with where you're at. Be realistic with your result. Keep in mind that, yes, we can get really, really cheap cost per click, that long after the sweet taste of low price fades, the bitter taste of poor quality remains. That it is not free to build your audience. But there are lots of things you can do. Like the less money you have, the more work you're going to do, right? Money doesn't fix, you know, having a big marketing spend budget doesn't even guarantee results. It just guarantees you're going to get to whatever results you're going to get faster. You can't manufacture desire with ads. People either resonate with the message that you're putting out there and want to be a part of it, or they don't. And you can buy ad space in their newsfeed all you want, but it's not going to, it's, you can lead a horse to water, but it's not going to make them drink. So,
okay. But question on that. Would you say then, is there some sense in like a lot of us are deciding like what our budget's going to be for marketing on a given song based on what song we think is the best? Is there any wisdom in waiting to see sort of what the audience loves and then putting more gasoline on that instead?
It depends on your audience. It depends on like your current, you know, if you've got a social media profile that's got a pretty highly active user base, like I would just so encourage you guys to not sleep on the magic of just playing the song on social media. Like no intro, no, I wrote this song because, no, whatever, just play the song, hit the chorus, right? Do a verse into a chorus, do a chorus into a bridge. Just give us something and leave it. Like, that's it. And see how it does. You know, we just got done with a year-long run with an artist named Jake and Shelby. When we started with Jake and Shelby, they were 700 followers on Instagram. And when we left August 1st, they're 800,000 followers on Instagram. at a couple hundred thousand monthly listeners, probably, I think, like 8 or 10 million streams between September and August 1. A lot of that was them just getting on and playing the song, and us then watching how the audiences responded to those songs. And again, they started with nothing. Everyone starts at zero, right? So if you're at zero, that's okay. Everyone starts at zero. But putting your songs out there more than once, more than twice, two or three times is not a sample size of data, right? So I think to bury into that question, a really good tip is that there is no such thing as failure. There's just feedback. And you've got to be willing to put your stuff out there more than once, more than twice, more than three times, and then make a decision on why didn't this work or why did this work? Because no matter how many points of data your analytics tools get or your marketing team's able to pull, it's all still a mirror dimly lit as to why that video got more views than the other one. We might make some good guesses, but ultimately there's just a big gap between the analytics that you get and the actual reality of why people responded. But yeah, I would put songs out as much as I can on socials and then let their performance on socials determine what we maybe take to the studio. Mm. And the magic of that too is, let's say you post a video of your song and it does really, really well. And then you know, you're posting other stuff. And then all of a sudden you go back to that song and it does really well again. And you do this 3 or 4 times and you've got a pretty strong, like, yeah, I really like this song from your audience. They're invested when you put that out, right? They're already in it to win it because they've been waiting for it. And I think the secret is when you're doing this strategy and you're putting out, you know, a verse into a chorus, I would never put out 100% of the song, right? Even if they took all those videos and played them back to back, there should always be something still behind the curtain. But yeah, in terms of, to go back to your original question of like, how do we, you know, if we've got a really small budget, what do we do? There is no one answer. There is no one size fits all approach. There's no like, for, there's not something that I would do carte blanche for every artist, no matter what. It is always a unique set of circumstances and situations for each artist and their current situation. If they're at zero, you know, it still is going to be dependent on their skill set and their abilities and their natural aptitude toward audience growth. I would say for sure, you guys should all get really, really, really cozy with the understanding that in an online world, perception is reality. And I know that's not always a really fun thing to think through. But yes, Jesus is a supreme reality, but perception is reality, right? So whether or not people like you're the best or the worst is irrelevant. It is there a perception that you are good, or is there a perception that there's nothing going on? And the number one thing that most artists are going to struggle with is that there's this catch-22 that nobody really cares about you until people already care about you. So how do you get them to care about you? So there are people that will knock going after, you know, playlist placements for monthly listeners or whatever, or getting more views on a video, or, you know, but the truth is that those outward facing metrics, like your Spotify monthly listeners or your YouTube views or your Instagram engagement, all of those create a perception that forms a reality. And if you're smart about understanding that these outward facing metrics are how people create their perception of you, then you can use your marketing budget fairly wisely to create a story that helps people actually pause more and spend time there. So I know that it feels a little, you've got to be as innocent as a dove, but also as shrewd as a snake about it.
Like this. I want to restate what I'm thinking you're saying. See if I'm understanding you right here. Mm-hmm. If I, as an independent artist, spend loads of money, let's say on a YouTube campaign, and there's 300,000 views on that song, people are going to look at it differently than if I just put it out with nothing and there's 30 views on the song.
Yes. If you, well, and also what I would do is, let's say, you know, 300,000 views, depending on your country targeting, that's anywhere from, you know, if you go really wide, again, some of these countries, there are click farms and there are, you know, you can get really, really cheap views. Like if I go and run a video view campaign on YouTube in Pakistan, it's going to be, you know, probably 75 views for a penny, if not more. Your budget goes really far. Whereas if you're doing like just North America, just United States, you're looking at 1 to 3 cents per view. So let's say you did far and wide and you get, you know, you spent $100 and you got 300,000 views. I would then take that and then go talk about it on my social media. Mm-hmm. I would then go put together some piece of content that is either thanking people or, you know, talking about how you're blown away that you've gotten so many views, like, or just celebrating the milestone along the way. Cause then people are going to be like, oh, there's something happening over there. Right. Like I can remember, you know, back in the day, are you going to put this on a podcast? I should maybe censor what label I'm talking about. I worked for a label that wanted to go to Christian radio with their music, and they were not already being placed on that radio station. And the radio station was like, hey guys, like there's just not enough market interest here. We're not really interested in this. And so we ran ads all through the weekend, burned the midnight oil, and racked up 1 million views in 3 days on a video. And so then we called them again on Monday morning and said, are you guys sure that there's not enough market interest? And that song ended up going on to win a Dove and a Grammy. And a huge component of that was that radio was willing to place it because we created this perception. And it was also, we knew that song was important. We knew that song was something that people needed. And we also understood that they're, you know, being as shrewd as a snake and innocent as a dove, if that program director needs to see views on YouTube to make that accepting decision to put that song in rotation, then we'll go get it. We targeted those views at people we thought would be relevant to it. So it was like, you know, it was a win for everybody. There's a bunch of people on YouTube that got to discover a song they normally wouldn't have because we put an ad in front of them, and so on and so forth. You know, it's a bunch of dominoes falling. But if you just look at it in terms of like, oh, well, you cranked up 1 million views just to trick that program director into it, like that's not real. That's one way of looking at it. But in reality, it was, well, let's see if we put this video in front of people, if they'll actually watch it. And that was what happened. They watched it, and then radio said yes. And then one day I will tell you what song that was. But for now.
Well, and at the end of the day, there's no deception, right? They're all real views. They're all, everyone really likes the song. It's like all the things are all really true. It's just really helpful. Let's say you're filling a blank radio station. It's really helpful if you're going to your station manager and saying, well, it's got 1 million views on it. Yeah. People obviously like it. There's here's the truth that I think in marketing, the story that you just told, sometimes people can feel like some sense of, ooh, that's a little dirty. We all do this every day. Mm-hmm. Like, so I posted something similar, but I'll make the connection here. The other day I said, if are people going to listen to the song the same way if you put Jason Ingram's name on it as a songwriter?
Yeah.
And I was really intrigued by what people said. But at the end of the day, all of us are biased. And so if you tell me there's two new movies out, one of them has a bunch of names of no one that you know, and the other one has Ryan Gosling in it, who's one of my favorite actors. And let's face it, ladies, I mean, come on.
Gosling all day long.
He's the best. Then I'll say, well, he picks great scripts. I love his acting. I'm going to watch that one first because I know I love his movies every time. The other one could actually be better and I might like it more. It's just I'm biased towards something I'm familiar with. And I have the perceived success that you're talking about.
Yeah. And it's that, you're also hitting it too with that familiarity thing. Like most people are not looking to go on an expedition and get lost in the Amazon rainforest, right? Most people are wanting to travel the known path and maintain familiarity because it's safe. And that is a core component of what keeps humans alive, is this preferential decision over making a safe decision instead of a risky, adventurous one. And every now and again, we might break out of that normal pattern and, you know, get that weird flavor of ice cream at Jenny's that we weren't expecting to get. But we all know that we wished we got our normal flavor. And so that Jason Ingram thing, like really the one of the biggest challenges any new artist has, there are a number of ways to go about it, but your job is to create brand awareness. Your job is you want people to have you come to the top of their mind when they're thinking about the particular genre or lane that you're creating music in. And again, there are a number of ways of doing that. You can do it through paid traffic. You can do it through social media. You can do it through a radio campaign. There's dozens and dozens and dozens of ways to do it, even within those lanes that I just discussed. So for us, it's like, what can you make as an artist? What do you like to make in terms of promotional content? And what do people like to see? And yeah, trying to live in the center of that Venn diagram. The other thing I will say is that no matter who you are, I am always, always, always going to yell from the top of every rooftop that there has got to be some component of acquiring your own audience data in your marketing efforts. What I mean by that is you don't just want people to follow you on social media. You want to have a text list. You want to have an email list. You want to have some sort of direct relationship between you and your fans that you're not renting, right? When you post to a social media platform, you don't own that audience. You don't control when they see or if they even log on again. But if you have their email address, you have their phone number, you can text them. You can communicate with them about literally anything you want too. There's a lot of freedom in what you say to your audience when you own it. And I see a lot of artists being like, well, I'll figure that out eventually. But let me just kind of frame it this way. On average, and this is a dated statistic, so that I would be interested to see the updated statistic. But as of like 2020, the average email for an artist was worth about $11 to $12 per year of income. And so when you think about $11 worth of income per email that you have versus like how many streams would they need to pay you $11, right? If the average fan is listening to about two of your songs a month, that's typically what we see is the retention rate for fans is you're going to get about two listens per month. Some are more, some are less, but usually about two. So let's live there. That's a penny a month. How many months of streaming versus I've got some sort of resource, I've got a product, I've got a Kickstarter, I've got a thing that they're willing to. And again, if we look at like Goldman Sachs just put out, you know, a big music monetization report, 60% of general market consumers want to spend money with an artist. And of the people that want to spend money with an artist, it's something like 85% of them would rather give to a smaller independent artist than an established artist. Mm. Right. So as an independent smaller artist, you have an advantage more than the majority of people want to purchase goods from artists. Right. And of the people that are wanting to purchase it, the vast majority of them are more interested in someone your size than Taylor Swift.
Mm. Isn't that fascinating? Major advantage for independent artists.
People love underdogs and they love being early adopters.
Yeah. So good. Well, we've got a bunch of folks on and we're going to hop to some Q&A. But before we do, as we wrap this portion of it, I wonder, Drew, would you say a prayer over us, all of us that are trying to market or communicate about our music in a way that has integrity? Would you pray over us?
Love that. Father God, just thank you so much for our time together today. And I just pray that we would all just have an encounter with the Spirit of Wisdom, that as we approach sharing our songs and our art with the world, that we would do it with intentionality and we would do it with sincerity and we'd do it with integrity, but we'd also do it with you in that process, and that your genius and your wisdom and your just insane ability to communicate would go before us and help us make a way in what is oftentimes a really confusing and frustrating space. And I pray that we would just all grow as sensitive listeners to learn from the process and learn from the decisions that we make, and that you would give ourselves an increased level of grace and mercy for ourselves in this process, that we'd be forgiving of, you know, making bad mistakes or doing something that maybe doesn't get the results that we hope, that you would teach us to just be humble and to be curious and to be passionate about helping other people connect with you in a more meaningful way. Amen.
I hope that was as meaningful for you as it was for us. If you're a songwriter and you're resonating with any of what you heard today, we'd love to get to know you more and introduce you to some folks in our community. All of our podcast interviews and guest lectures come from either our Writing Club monthly breakouts or our annual Writing Worship Conference. Check out the show notes to learn how to get more involved with Writing Club, our mentorship taught by our founder, Chrissy Nordoff, or stuff we talked about in today's episode. Find us on Facebook at the Writing Worship Community, on Instagram at writingworship.co, and our website, writingworship.co. We love meeting new folks and supporting songwriters, so be sure to stop in, say hello, and get to know us a little bit. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The times I've grown most as a songwriter are the times I've had mentors showing me the way. If you're looking to grow as a songwriter, we're now accepting applications for our Worship Songwriter Mentorship. Now, it's available only a few times each year. The Worship Songwriter Mentorship is a songwriting intensive that will help you craft impactful worship songs. It's a course created by Dove Award-winning and Grammy-nominated, drumroll here please, our founder, pro songwriter Chrissy Nordoff. It's a small group community, and it's led by other songwriters over the course of 9 weeks. It's an intensive course and a small group co-writing environment, and that means you'll be added to a special group of about 12 writers, give or take. Each group is led by experienced songwriters, some of them my dear, dear friends, and I've even gotten to lead a group or two. Rachel here, by the way. We love the church, and we love to champion fellow worship songwriters just like yourself. In this mentorship, you'll learn how to write songs for you and your congregation. You'll go deeper in your intimacy with Jesus. You'll get the tools needed to help craft songs more easily and never run out of creative ideas. Okay, I know it sounds too good to be true, but trust me, this course is a game changer. You'll learn how to leverage your unique songwriting personality and connect with other like-minded writers in a meaningful way. Truly, I can't think of another course, group of people, community that has impacted my songwriting the way that this mentorship has. If you're wanting to take the next steps in your songwriting journey, then apply now at the link in our show notes. We hope to see you there.